A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Now, I know I said yesterday we're going to be talking with John Diedrich from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a great event held in Wausau, Wisconsin last week about gun owners and mental health. And I feel bad. I've already apologized to John, as a matter of fact, because originally John and I were supposed to talk on Wednesday, but that got pushed back because of the NRA board meetings. And then I let him know today, hey, you know what? I don't normally do a show on Fridays, but we're going to do a special Cam and Company highlighting our conversation, highlighting this event, because I have something else I need to talk about on today's show. And that is this piece by Nick Pinzenstadler at USA Today. And the original headline of Nick's story, hacked data exposes new nightmare for U.S. gun industry. And he's writing about the hack of Mexican military intelligence and a lot of data relating to straw purchases, guns that were trafficked south of the border into Mexico. Does not, in my opinion, constitute a new nightmare for the firearms industry. In fact, I think it undoes a lot of the claims of the Mexican government that the firearms industry is actively aiding and abetting cartel violence. Both my colleague Tom Knight and I wrote about Pinzenstadler's piece on Wednesday at Bearing Arms. But Wednesday night, I heard from Pete Frisselli, retired ATF assistant deputy director, who at one point in his career in law enforcement was a supervisor in the ATF Phoenix field office. Now, you know, Pete wrote a memoir about Operation Fast and Furious. He was one of the Fast and Furious whistleblowers. And in his book, he talks a lot about the problems bringing cases in Phoenix, even before Operation Fast and Furious began. Pete was also quoted in Nick Pinzenstadler's report for USA Today, briefly discussing Operation Fast and Furious, because one of the revealing things about the information that was leaked out is that fully half of the biggest straw buyers in the Mexican government's data are connected to Operation Fast and Furious, which, of course, was when the DOJ under Eric Holder allowed thousands of guns to walk across the border into Mexico and into the hands of the cartels without ever trying to interdict those weapons, without ever trying to stop the traffickers. The theory goes that they were going to somehow keep track of these guns, and then they would make arrests in Mexico, and they'd be able to, you know, wrap up high-level cartel members. They never explained how that was going to happen when they had no way of tracking the guns once they crossed the border. But that was their story, and they've stuck to it by and large. So to me, the release of this data shows how much of a problem the Obama administration has been when it comes to aiding and abetting the cartels. But that's not the narrative that the Mexican government wants to tell. So anyway, Pete and I were chatting last night, and I said, you know what, why don't you come on the show today and talk about this? You've got not only your opinion, but you've got a wealth of institutional knowledge about how things operated in Phoenix, Arizona, that I think is a direct counter to the narrative that is presented by USA Today and Nick Pinzenstadler. So without any further ado, here is our conversation with Pete Frisselli, talking about what's going on at the border and what's going on in the media when it comes to trying to pin the blame for cartel violence on the U.S. firearms industry. Take a look and a listen. Pete, thanks so much for coming on the program today. It's great to see you, sir.
Good to see you as well, Cam.
So USA Today releases this big investigation that's not much of an investigation, but we had this hack of a Mexican military database, and USA Today, I guess, got this information, and they're describing this as a nightmare for the firearms industry. And I got to say, Pete, I mean, as I'm looking through Nick Pinzenstadler's story, I'm not seeing the evidence that this is a nightmare for the firearms industry. I'm seeing this as a nightmare for the ATF. I'm seeing this as a nightmare for former Attorney General Eric Holder, for former President Barack Obama, for Steve Dettelbach, for the Mexican government. But I also ran across your name in this story. I want to ask you about this because Nick Pinzenstadler quotes you Because I got to back up here for just a second here. So half, Pinson Stadler writes, half of the biggest straw buyers that are listed in this leaked database came from Operation Fast and Furious. Now, he kind of blows by that, but he does talk with you. There's a quote from you talking about how this is appalling. And there was another, I guess, another quote talking about how, you know, you're not surprised to see these guns from Fast and Furious are still showing up because guns are not like bread. They don't disappear.
Sure.
I want to ask Pete, what else did you tell Pinson Stadler that didn't show up in his story?
Oh, there was a lot. I mean, I spoke about how, you know, the United States Attorney's Office would not allow us to arrest folks when we got tips from the industry. I explained to him how 90% of the tips that we got came from licensed gun dealers. And it wasn't just tips on straw buyers. It was tips on folks who were, you know, selling guns illegally, you know, because, look, it was a thing back at the gun shows. We'd have folks saying, hey, private sales off paper. And the dealers would spot them before we did very oftenly. Oftenly is not a word. And they would call us. So, I mean, you know, and then also felons trying to buy guns. You could tell some of these folks had just gotten out. They had the SS bolts tattooed on their neck, Aryan Brotherhood types. So, I mean, they were, as former Director Jones and as former Acting Director Brandon used to say, the first line of defense in preventing violent crime involving guns. So, I mean, that was blown past. The other thing I found disingenuous is how he talks about 2,000 guns walked between 2006 and 2011. Well, if you notice, that kind of extends it beyond the Obama term into Bush. Look, Fast and Furious started in September of 2009, October of 2009, and ended shortly after Brian Terry was murdered in 2011. That happened squarely on Obama's watch. So that kind of bothered me because we spoke about this at length. But there were other things too. And look, I did mention how the Fast and Furious guns, they'll be turning up at crime scenes long after I'm dead, even if I die an old man, because 2,000 guns walked and only probably about 1,000 have been recovered. So, but he took that phrase and kind of extended it into some Tucson cases that I had no visibility on. Doesn't mean it's a lie. I mean, a gun is a gun and a gun is not going to biodegrade if it's taken care of. It can last a lifetime, as we see with some of these collector's items that are available now. But I did find it really infuriating. And then to look at some of the guns that they're saying are these sought after crime guns, the Smith & Wesson Model 10, I carried one of those as a brand new rookie cop in New York City in 1987 till we got the Glocks, I think, in 1991. That is absolutely laughable. And then the Jennings J22, I don't want to badmouth Jennings. I don't know that I would ever carry one. It's just not a gun I would choose. I don't know that the cartels are using those in mass killings. Look, there's a lot of things that could be done better. That article, I think, was more of a hit job on the industry. And then look, I also think that it was conveniently leaked right before there's going to be this lawsuit against the Arizona dealers, one of which we dealt with, Spriggs, who was cooperative with us. And I never heard of the other dealers, which actually speaks volumes too, because if they were a problem, I would have heard of them back in the day. I never heard of the other dealers. Spriggs, like I said, very cooperative, helpful, very close to the Mexican border because they're based in Yuma, but proximity is not a crime. It's, you know, I mean, just appalling, appalling.
Right. I mean, I guess the attitude is if you live within 100 miles of the border, then maybe you don't have a gun store near you. Right. Maybe we shouldn't have gun stores. Maybe your Second Amendment rights could be inconvenienced because of the potential for the drug cartels to traffic in these firearms, which, of course, is an absolutely absurd position to take. But then again, you know, the most ardent of the gun control activists don't want gun stores anywhere in the United States, not just within 100 miles of the border. But, you know, I want to get back to the list of the most commonly recovered firearms, because this, again, is part of the allegation by the Mexican government's attorneys going after the gun makers. Right. So you've got two different lawsuits. You've got the suit against the Arizona dealers, and then you've got the gun manufacturers who are being sued to the tune of $10 billion by the Mexican government, claiming that they are knowingly aiding and abetting cartel violence by manufacturing these firearms and not imposing, you know, gun control measures within their company or within the industry itself. It's a convoluted argument. I don't think it holds up, particularly, again, when you start to look at the most commonly recovered firearms, or at least those that are most commonly traced. As you mentioned, Smith & Wesson Model 10, The Jennings J-22, which you might not want to speak badly about Jennings. I don't think Jennings is around. I mean, it's been sold. It was Bryko Arms, and then it was Jimenez Arms. I don't know what it is now. But look, the J-22 has a reputation to be one of the jankiest pistols ever manufactured.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can find, I think it was in 78 when it went on sale, I think it was $50. And I have not gone searching, but I've been told you can find them for even cheaper than that now. So that doesn't to me indicate that the cartels are going out there and I got to get my hands on the J-22, right? They're getting what is available to them. And look, I have no doubt that the cartels want to arm themselves with American made firearms. I have no doubt about that. But that's a very different argument than saying that the firearms industry, whether it's an FFL on the border or a gun maker in Tennessee, is knowingly allowing them to acquire weapons and is aiding and abetting this cartel activity, which is the allegation of this argument.
Right. Well, they forget to tell people, and let's be honest, look, straw purchasing is a crime, right? You're buying a gun with the intent on trafficking it to somebody else who's going to take it to wherever, or someone who you know shouldn't have that gun. And we've seen it happen sometimes. And look, they're rarely prosecuted unless it's a high profile shooting. Like when that firefighter was killed in upstate New York, they identified who straw purchased it, was a female. They prosecuted her. More often than not, they're not prosecuted. But that's part of the problem. Because what happened in Phoenix was we were getting tipped off time and time and time again about these straw purchasers by dealers. So we would recommend them for prosecution and be told over 90% of the time, nah, sorry, hard pass. Well, so that's not on the dealer, right? And then let's remember something. A straw purchase is an act of deception, right? So when a dealer sees something suspicious, they're calling us. But when that person's really good at that deception and they manage to pull off that straw purchase, right? Sometimes those guns are going to get sold. They would turn up in Mexico. Well, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Arizona had a solution for that too. Once the gun is in Mexico, the corpus delicti, the body of the crime is in Mexico, they wouldn't take those cases, right? So again, we got the tips on those cases from the dealers and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Arizona, hard pass. And sometimes, Cam, in cases where there were multiple bodies tied to those guns.
Yeah.
So again, by the time that gun crossed the border, usually two crimes were committed. The straw purchase, again, that's not a crime committed by a dealer, and the dealer's deceived. In a way, the dealer is in some essence a victim of that crime. Correct. And then the person that trafficked it across the border is committing another felony. There was no desire to go after those criminals, but now all of a sudden is this huge appetite to go after the industry. And look, I know that some of your listeners are not going to like me because of what I did for 20 years. But the reality is I always viewed the industry as a partner. And I've said this, one of the reasons we talked about this in the past, I view this as we left, you know, in the military, never leave a man behind. In law enforcement, never leave a man behind. In this pursuit of, you know, what's going on here and in what's going on with the zero tolerance push by ATF, we are leaving a man behind, right? The industry in most instances were noble folks. During my time in Arizona, we did identify one dirty FFL who in his post-arrest statements admitted, yeah, about 1,000 of my guns went to Mexico. Who cares? He was coaching people on what to say if you get pulled over by ATF, how many guns to buy, when to buy the guns, because he knew when we were working, when we weren't working, right? U.S. Attorney's Office declined that case 3 times. So, I mean, you can't have it both ways. And again, the industry, very, very, very few of the folks I met in the industry that one was the only one in my 20 years. And I'm not going to say I worked in every part of the country. So I know there are others, but 99% of the folks I've met have been solid, good people. To demonize them is just, it's unfortunate. It's disingenuous. And I'll use the word again. It's appalling to me.
You know, there was a line in Pinson Stadler's story where he talked about, I think some 78,000 firearms that were recovered. I can't remember what the time period was. And of those, I think he said 22,000 and change were traced back to the United States. Now, I thought that was a pretty eye-opening statement. And he also talked about how those were guns that were sold legally in the United States or imported into Mexico, which is another important thing that the Mexican government really doesn't want to talk about in their lawsuit, right? We know that guns are being sold to the Mexican military, to Mexican law enforcement, and then they're being diverted to the cartels once they're in Mexico, right? Do you have any idea, Pete, how big of a problem that is?
Well, there are a lot of guns that are coming up from South and Central America. There are a lot of guns that are being diverted from Mexican military and Mexican law enforcement stashes. But I want to read something to you, Cam, because I got a lot of messages yesterday. And one of these messages came from a gentleman who worked for ATF in Mexico. I'm going to be a little bit, this is probably a little PG-13.
Okay.
But he read the story. And here's what he texted me. I'll show you the text so you can see I'm not full of shit. Here we go. Right. As the guy who implemented Spanish e-trace in Mexico and worked very closely with Sinapi, which is the Mexican folks to do the tracing, I would bet my left nut that the data is at least 10 years old and not nearly complete. In fact, I would bet my other nut, Sinapi, is corrupt and incompetent.
I mean, when you're willing to bet your nuts, you know, that's...
Yeah,
no,
well, his follow-up statement, which I'll put here again, is, with that said, Bill Newell and his band of misfits, which is the cast of characters from Fast and Furious, are the equivalent of herpes. So, again, this is Fast and Furious, the gift that keeps giving to some degree, where ATF intentionally walked guns. And remember, there was a point where some of those dealers contacted ATF and with their lawyers sat down and said, hey, we know that these are straw purchasers. And they were tipping off the agents just like they did us. Like when they tipped us off, we were outside. We talked about this many times. Stopped the cars, asked the questions. We did what cops do all over the country. In Fast and Furious, as you know, and some of your listeners might not have tuned in the past, the guns were allowed to ride off to the sunset. So when these dealers and their lawyers met with ATF, right, and DOJ attorneys, prosecutors, important to note, they were told, hey, keep doing this. We need you to do this. We're building this big, great case, right? That's the tone that was set in Arizona. Don't blame the dealers for what was happening at the direction of the people who regulate them and the right. people who could prosecute them.
Absolutely. But, you know, I think it's also important to go back to something you said earlier that so there was Operation Fast and Furious and everything that went on with Fast and Furious. But even before Operation Fast and Furious began, when you were in Phoenix, you were having issues with the U.S. Attorney's Office to bring cases, right? They didn't want to bring these cases. So this is before the DOJ was officially allowing guns to be walked across the border. Right. There was still an issue where prosecution was not what it needed to be.
Oh, without a doubt. And look, you've read the book. I know that My book outlines from 2007 when I first got there, which was late February 2007 until Fast and Furious, because a path was paved by inept prosecutors and poor leadership that allowed Fast and Furious to even happen. That's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. So, yes, to your point. But what I didn't like in the article was it kind of insinuated that this was a program that was enacted from 2006 to 2011. Well, that gives the Obama administration a pass. There were some cases in the past, wide receiver, shitty case, about 150 guns. The intent in that investigation, and I wasn't involved in it, but my understanding is it wasn't intentionally walking guns into Mexico. It was a horribly managed case. There was another case, the Hernandez case. In that case, they tipped off Mexico, hey, the guns are coming. Unbeknownst to them, the Mexican folks working on the border didn't give a crap because they were beholden to the plaza bosses and they let the guns through. But the intent was for there to be a seizure at the border, right? So, but for so many reasons, like even with Fast and Furious, let's go back to what I said. They had this corpus delicti policy that said, hey, once the gun goes into Mexico, we can't prosecute it, right? And I'm talking about a lot of cases, and I'm talking about some cases. One of them I talk about in the book. Not to plug the book too much, 21 bodies tied to one of those guns that was only bought 48 hours earlier, and they wouldn't take it. Well, then in Fast and Furious, the plan becomes let the guns go to Mexico. And that's what's frustrating to me is, wait, for years you wouldn't take our cases because the guns were trafficked into Mexico. And again, without the knowledge of the FFLs, you know, completely without their knowledge. Now, all of a sudden, that's your strategy. It made no sense. And then a lot of the other things that we did to make cases in other parts of the country, they prohibited as well, like proffering. So if we did identify a straw purchaser and we were able to arrest them and we wanted to bring them in and sit them down with their lawyer and interview them and find out, hey, who are you working with? We weren't allowed to do that either. In fact, that caused quite a stir at the hearing when I testified on June 15th. If you watch, no one watches C-SPAN, but it's still on there. Trey Gowdy, who's a former prosecutor, got all spun up about that. So then what happened is Eric Holder, who was now covering his ass, wrote a memo to all of DOJ saying, hey, from this point forward, firearms arrest defendants will be proffered. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Arizona decided at that point to change the definition, their office's definition, of a proffer. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And it's appalling to me, like I said, that they're specifically targeting Arizona gun dealers, where you had this, the federal prosecutors were part of the, you know, group of folks who were tasked with stemming the flow of firearms into Mexico, could not have cared less for at least 5 years while I was in Phoenix. And here's the kicker. I've heard it's just as bad now as it was then, so much so that Steve Dettelbach, who I'm not a huge fan of his leadership, as you know, flew to Phoenix to go and talk to the U.S. attorney to explain, hey, look, what's going on here? And let's add some other fuel to this fire. The Arizona U.S. attorney, right, Gary Restaino, was the acting ATF director for about 1 year to 1.5 years before Dettelbach was even appointed. You can't make this shit up.
He's now the U.S. attorney in Arizona?
He is still, but he was the U.S. attorney in Arizona that was detailed to go work as the ATF director. So he's the acting director. One of the characters, Rachel Hernandez, whose name you might remember from The Fast and Furious, who was one of the preventers from us doing our job out there, was the acting U.S. attorney in his absence, right? And so he's now the ATF director. Then when Dettelbach gets appointed, he goes back to being the Arizona U.S. attorney, and Rachel Hernandez goes back to her role as the number two of that office. Again, truth is sometimes stranger than fiction.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, so, you know, you can look at this investigation from USA Today and, you know, are there some truths in there? Sure. But to me, it's what's not being told. Right. When you only present some of the facts, then you can create a narrative that is inaccurate, ultimately, even if you're relying on factual information, because it's what you're leaving out. And so Penn and Statler's story doesn't mention all of, I mean, again, briefly references Operation Fast and Furious, but as you say, tries to tie it back to the Bush administration, right? So we can avoid, any sort of, partisan consequences for the Obama administration. And then ignores, as you say, the policies of the U.S. Attorney's Office, ignores the work that FFLs were doing to try to prevent trafficking and to prevent these straw purchases. The entire thrust of this article is that the gun industry are the bad guys here, right? Whether it's the gun dealers on the border in places like Yuma, or again, the firearms manufacturers in Tennessee or Georgia. But if you're looking for somebody wearing the black hat, look to the gun industry. That's the message that Penns and Statler wants to get out with this story. And I think that's why not just you, but some of your former colleagues are so furious about this, not because you're tools of the gun lobby, but because that's a false story. That's not what is happening here.
No, absolutely. And look, like I said, I got a lot of messages yesterday about that. And a lot of them were texts. A lot of people were quite heated about it. But look, I found it just really suspicious that this was leaked right before this trial is about to start going. Clearly, they're trying to win hearts and minds through the media. I just hope that folks who are hearing this stuff will take the extra step to really educate themselves about what happened. Based on what I'm seeing in our country, I don't think that's going to be the case, because folks tend to believe whatever they hear and whatever side, of the aisle they're on, whatever media, entities are on that side, say something, they believe it wholeheartedly. I found it to be disingenuous and appalling. And I just hope the truth gets out there a little bit more so that folks will be educated and they can make educated decisions. Look, this case should be thrown out of court, in my opinion, because like I said, that by the time the gun made it to Mexico, there are crimes committed and they're not being committed by the dealers.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, I'm glad that you could join me on the program today. You're always going to get more than a soundbite when you come on the show, because I want folks to hear what you have to say. And I do appreciate you pushing back against this, Pete, because you're right. I mean, we've got the Arizona gun dealer case, which is going to trial. The Mexico versus Smith and Wesson et al. There's a request to actually dismiss that case, which is pending before the Supreme Court. I think the reply from Mexico is due in early July. So it'll be a while before the Supreme Court gets a hold of that case. But, that case was originally dismissed by a district court judge. And then the First Circuit reinstated this case on really dubious grounds. So hopefully the Supreme Court does the right thing here. And in the meantime, you've got the election for Mexico's next president. I hope to God the people of Mexico have a candidate who can get tough on the cartels, because you and I haven't really talked much about this. But what do you think about Obrador's hugs, not bullet strategy of dealing with the cartels?
It's a joke, but I'm going to give you a little insight. And I know we're kind of pressed for time. I don't know if you know this. From roughly 2008 till Fast and Furious, Mexico had a Mexican, I don't mean Mexican, American, a Mexican federal prosecutor assigned to the Phoenix Field Division. Right. So he was a Mexican prosecutor who was assigned to us. He didn't have access to trace that, anything like that. He was there to help coordinate prosecutions of people in Mexico that were related to the smuggling routes, right? no people, zero prosecutions occurred because of this man's work. So he was on a 3-year vacation, basically, in Phoenix, did nothing. He did lose a few case reports that we were generated specifically in relation to a grenade smuggling case that's in the book. But he was actually asked to leave the country because the same guy that texted me, by the way, who was assigned in Mexico, we found out that instead of doing his job, he was downloading hardcore pornography on his Mexican-issued PGR, which is the Mexican Federal Prosecutor's laptop. The sites that he was downloading, I wouldn't even mention on your podcast because they're like disgusting and X-rated. So he was, not only did he prosecute nobody, all he succeeded to do while he was in the United States was apparently look at hardcore pornography in his office with the door closed. So Mexico's really taken this seriously over the years, as you can see.
Yeah. Holy cow. Pfercelli, thank you, man, for coming on the program today. It is always good talking with you. I hope we get a chance to do this again soon. But I appreciate the insight today, brother.
Sure. Same here, brother. God bless. Well, take care.
You too. My thanks to Pete for joining me on the program. And again, apologies to John Dedrick from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We will have, hopefully, unless we have some tech issues, hopefully we'll have a Friday show for you talking with John about this incredibly important event held last week in Wausau, Wisconsin. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of North Carolina, High Point, North Carolina, where a man arrested for recent violent crimes, wanted by several agencies, Camarion Franklin, wanted on stolen vehicle charges, as well as charges of shooting somebody during the commission of a robbery. As it turns out, this is not Franklin's first rodeo. High Point police say officers served several felony warrants, including probation violations and possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, to 19-year-old Camarion Franklin after a standoff at an apartment in High Point. They said Franklin came out of the apartment after barricading himself inside for a few hours. When investigators were able to enter the premises, they found two guns inside. They've charged Franklin in connection to three recent crimes in High Point. Back on May the 10th, police believe that Franklin shot somebody during a robbery. That victim thankfully treated and released at a local hospital. About a month earlier, April 9th, police believe that Franklin stole a truck and an iPad Pro from a home. And a couple of days before that, April 6th, police say they tried to pull Franklin over after spotting him in a stolen car. They say he hit a patrol vehicle and then sped off. Now, in addition to those crimes that police believe that Franklin was involved in, he was also wanted by the Guilford County Sheriff's Office, the police in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, as well as the North Carolina Department of Probation and Parole. And as if that's not enough, WFMY reports that in addition to the crimes in High Point, Franklin is also wanted for other crimes. Guilford County Sheriff's Office, for example, has a list of charges, including robbery with a firearm, assault with a deadly weapon, inflicting serious injury, breaking and entering, larceny, vandalism, felon possessing a firearm, obstructing an officer. Winston-Salem charges for possession of a firearm by a felon, as well as felony possession of a motor vehicle. Probation and parole office says that he has violated his parole on several different occasions. The one thing that WFMI did not report is what was the original felony conviction for Camarion Franklin. He's 19 years old. He's already a convicted felon. He's already facing multiple felon possession charges for being a convicted felon possession of a firearm, in addition to the violent crimes that he's accused of committing. But what was the original charge that resulted in Franklin being a felon at 19 years of age? And did Franklin serve any time at all behind bars for that felony offense? Or was this a slap on the wrist and a see you later, maybe quicker than everybody realized? But that's the information we don't know. And hopefully we'll learn more about this. But again, 19 years old, I'm guessing whatever sentence he received for that felony offense did not make much of an impression on young Mr. Franklin, given the bevy of charges that he is currently facing. You are innocent until proven guilty, of course, but there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, at least in the court of public opinion, to point to some real issues with Mr. Franklin being able to stay on the straight and narrow. So we'll keep our eyes out for any more details on that story. Today's Armed Citizen story from WFTV in Orlando, Florida. Incident in Osceola County. And now a burglary suspect is facing charges after they were shot by a homeowner. There you go. The headline, burglar shot by woman protecting her family inside Kissimmee home, according to deputies in Osceola County. It was Monday night Deputies called out to a home on Royal Palm Drive. When they got there, they said they ordered David Martinez Estrada to exit a home. Instead, he went deeper inside the residence. Deputies say that a woman then shot Martinez Estrada when he forced his way into the bedroom that she and her family were in. Don't have a lot of circumstances about a lot of details about the circumstances of this. It's unknown, for example, whether Martinez Estrada knew the family, whether this was some sort of attempted burglary gone bad. But whatever the rationale for Martinez Estrada, when he presented a threat to the family inside that home, the armed homeowner shot the intruder, protecting herself and her family. She's not facing any charges, but as I mentioned, David Martinez Estrada most certainly is. Finally, today's good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Back to North Carolina, where a man who suffered a heart attack, multiple heart attacks actually, just a few months ago, before being revived by a police officer, is now given back. This man in Cramerton, North Carolina, has gifted his local police department with defibrillators. As sort of a way of paying it forward. Rick Brooks, back in January, said he cardiac arrested three times, said he passed out on the floor of the living room of his home. His wife tried to help, but she was unable to get a pulse going. He says, I would have been dead. But then Officer Joel Kula showed up. Brooks, talking to WSOC in Charlotte, said the officer told his wife, I'm most likely going to have to break his ribs so we can start a massage on his heart. And that's what he did. He ended up massaging the 7-year-old's heart until medics arrived. Brooks says, I'm just fortunate to be alive. He was in recovery for 6 weeks. He said, my wife says, you've got another chance. So he decided, you know what? I want to do something to help. He decided to buy several defibrillators, give them to the police department there so they could have them in patrol cars. He said, I don't want anybody to experience what I experienced. This is not anything more than trying to give back. Brooks had the opportunity to thank Officer Kulish in person during a recent city council meeting. And this morning, he is presenting the devices to the police department during a concert in downtown Cramerton, North Carolina. So in the right place, which is right here, still breathing at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Rick Brooks, Cramerton, North Carolina. Hoping to save other lives after his life was saved. And we thank you, sir, for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I appreciate you being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you back here for a special Friday edition, which is good as we head into a Memorial Day holiday. I probably will not be doing a Cam and Company on Monday. I don't think anybody's going to be around to help produce that show. So instead of a Monday show, you'll get a Friday show. Works out well for everybody, hopefully. All right, so we'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And if you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member. Just use the promo code SAVEAMERICA. You can get a significant savings on your membership. You'll get exclusive content, an ad-free experience, the ability to comment on stories, and more. And you'll be supporting the independent pro-Second Amendment journalism that we're doing at Bearing Arms, which is critically important in this day of big tech censorship and, well, anti-gun media bias like we've been discussing on today's program. So again, use the promo code SAVEAMERICA for a 50% discount on your VIP or VIP Gold membership. And thank you again. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.